Welcome to The Right Chamber, the podcast that takes you inside the NHS to explore what really makes a hospital a hospital.
Each episode, we sit down with the people who keep healthcare moving, from doctors, nurses on the front line, to students, the support teams, administrators, corporate staff, and everyone in between. These are the voices that often go unheard, but together they form the heartbeat of our hospitals.
Our aim is simple: to share authentic stories that are accessible to the public, meaningful to NHS staff, and a reminder that healthcare is more than treatments and wards. It's a whole community working together.
So whether you're part of the NHS family or simply curious about the people behind the service, join us as we open the doors to the conversations that matter here in the Right Chamber.
Dr. Paul Hudson qualified from the University of Birmingham in 1997 and was appointed as consultant anaesthetist in 2009. He became deputy medical director in 2018, operational medical director in 2022, and medical director in 2026. He led the Dudley Group COVID-19 response as senior responsible officer and has joined regional NHS roles, including virtual ward clinical lead. Hello and welcome back to The Right Chamber. I'm Victor.
And I'm Jaspreet. Today we're joined by Paul Hudson, medical director at Russell's Hull Hospital.
In this episode, we explore Paul's journey from consultant anaesthetist into senior leadership and what that transition really involves.
We also break down what a medical director actually does and take an honest look at some of the biggest challenges facing the NHS right now.
From supporting resident doctors and navigating industrial action to what the future of the NHS might look like.
This is a conversation about leadership, trust, and what it takes to keep a hospital running.
Let's get into it.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Paul Hudson, consultant anaesthetist, and as of February, the medical director at Dudley Group.
Very lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
Lovely to meet you.
Before we start, for the benefit of our public, what is your role?
Yeah, so the medical director, it's quite a big role. I think there are certain legal responsibilities, and then there's the kind of the wider kind of responsibilities within the trust. So I'm what's known as a responsible officer. So every doctor has a license to practice and they're registered with the GMC, but they have to be connected to a designated body, a hospital or something like that. And that hospital has to have a responsible officer. So I'm responsible for overseeing the doctor's registrations, their annual appraisal, and the revalidating their fitness to practice, as well as kind of doing any regulatory issues or kind of investigations or helping a doctor in difficulty. And more broadly in the trust, my portfolio includes a number of different things. I think one, medical education. So kind of overseeing the quality of our training of both kind of our undergraduate students, but our postgraduate doctors, to make sure we're kind of doing the best we can to train our doctors. Responsible for overseeing research and development, because we are in the process of trying to become a university hospital. So really kind of trying to lean into kind of upping our research portfolios and embracing innovation. And as well as that, I'm responsible for professional standards and medical standards. So kind of broadly overseeing kind of the quality of care within the organization together with the chief nurse.
So we step back a little bit. You are an aesthetics consultant, yes?
Yes, yes.
So what sparked your interest to become and take over such a big role?
It's difficult to say. I think kind of if you asked me 25 years ago, would I be a medical director? I'd have said no. and I think it's just that slow evolution. Like sometimes when you start at medical school, you don't quite know which specialty's right for you, or kind of, you know, which hospital setting's going to be right for you, or even kind of your primary care. And I think it was just a natural evolution for me, really. I think when I started as a consultant anaesthetist, my interests were kind of big case anaesthesia. I kind of did a lot of vascular anaesthesia, and I'd done a PGCME, so I thought I was going to try and get involved in medical education. But I think when I joined the trust, I got involved in some quality improvement projects, and actually I think it was really good working outside of my little bubble, actually meeting kind of the wider team, kind of, you know, the operational managers, the nursing, they're working with the MDT to kind of improve, you know, the pathways and the flow of patients through the organization. So I think that just sparked my interests. I think the first thing I did was, it's still running now, the abscess pathway. We used to admit patients with abscesses and they'd wait on the emergency list for 2 or 3 days before they got done, but actually kind of rearranging that. So it was done on a planned day case thing, and actually kind of the difference we made to those individual patients' journey was incredible. And then, the whole kind of interest sparked from there, and it just, people kept asking me to do other things. So kind of, will you be service lead? Okay. Will you be clinical director? Okay. Deputy mentor? Oh, okay. And here I am.
Wow. So it's a lot of just kind of saying yes to the opportunities.
And wanting to improve.
And wanting to improve.
Yes.
I think there is, because I think that's, you look at it and think, actually, it's nice to make a difference, if you know what I mean. And sometimes the bigger the role, the bigger the difference, if you know what I mean. So I think that kind of kept the interest going.
After that kind of change and now being in a more, leadership position within the trust, what are the challenges kind of facing our doctors, frontline workers that you kind of have to oversee to make sure we have a plan of action against them? What would be the main things at the moment?
I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, I think kind of, and I think that's kind of important to acknowledge at this stage. I think anybody who's watched the news over this last winter has seen the NHS under an extreme amount of pressure. A large number of patients coming in through our front door portals, and at times, due to the nature of some of the patients, frail elderly, we're struggling to kind of get them out back into kind of the community and places of care. So we've been very full. And I think kind of the main challenge is it's very difficult in those situations to deliver care at the levels to which we aspire to. We've all seen on the news kind of examples of patients being cared for in corridors and things like that. And that's not what we aspire to and not how we want to deliver it. And I think the main challenge is the kind of the impact that has on the staff delivering that care, that actually knowing you're coming to work and it's going to be hard and difficult and not being able to do the really good quality work that you want to do, that does take its toll on people kind of after a while.
This is affecting, yes, the doctors, the nurses, the frontline workers, but then we also have to remember, there's the patients on the other end of things. And as you said, there's a kind of level that we aspire to be. And I guess the crux of it is that we have a mentality of kind of continuous improvement and looking at where we are, seeing what changes need to be made, and then enforcing some implementation of those changes, and then reassessing again. And as you said, it's a difficult climate generally, I think, within the NHS. And you have this trust to, and so many doctors to be responsible for.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to be able to take a step back at times and kind of retain the sense and kind of just that focus on quality. So I know things are difficult, but if you look at the quality metrics and really focus on what's important, I mean, and I think for me as medical director, one of the things you look at is mortality, kind of mortality rates and how you compare. And, for Dudley Group, our mortality rates are excellent, if you know what I mean. They're below the national average. There's always kind of improvements to make, but we've done that over the last few years by really focusing on areas where we had to improve: sepsis, stroke, fractured neck and femur, patients with broken hips. These are all very, very high risk groups, and we've really focused on the pathways and the quality of those pathways. So despite everything that's going on, if you focus on the real quality and kind of delivering care in a timely manner when it really matters, then actually you can maintain your performance and safety. And most importantly, as you say, the patient outcomes kind of in a challenging environment. And I think whilst it feels hard, we should be very proud of that. That actually kind of we've been through a really difficult winter, but our quality metrics and our outcomes are still good. And that is a real testament to our staff and how hard they've worked and how hard they've adapted.
Because it's very easy to like look from the outside and say, well, you are still seeing patients in the corridors. You know, the wait times are like 10 hours, this and that. But I don't think people realize that the little changes are making, even if it's a small change, but it matters. Like each pathway actually accelerates the patient getting a bed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's what they say in that advert, every little helps. Yes. And I think it's that kind of, there's no magic bullet. There's no one thing that's going to make everything magically better, but everybody can play their part in it. And it's just kind of half a day saved here, almost an hour quicker transferred, or one patient being able to be cared for in the community and not brought to hospital. All these things stack up and all of a sudden it's kind of, we make a difference. And I think, I think anyone who works on site will know, kind of in the last few weeks, our challenge was the same as a lot of other organisations challenging. When we're full, we were struggling to get patients off ambulances and often holding them on the back of an ambulance before we could take that handover safely. Over the last 4 weeks, we've done a real big bit of quality improvement work, and we're now able to get, you know, the vast majority of patients off an ambulance in under 15 minutes. So actually it's just testament to actually, if you focus on those pathways and that quality improvement, it can be done. And I think our challenge now is to make the changes we've made sustainable, which I think is the hardest bit of the quality improvement work. You do a project, you focus on it, yeah, things get better. And then
how do we maintain it?
How do you kind of make that? We're going to be doing that next month, next year, the year after. It's going to become business as usual. And I think that's our challenge, because we've proven we can do it.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you know, and it's good to see that kind of future thinking, not just putting temporary resolves for these kind of challenges. And you know, we have to remember, just as you said, these are general challenges facing the NHS at wide. So it's really about what can we do, or can I do in my role, what can we all do in our individual roles for our trust, our local trust. And as you said, it's, you know, these metrics are promising that we are meeting the national average of those expected waiting times and all the other metrics, and even mortality, as you said as well. So it's very reassuring, you know, that the public, you know, the local Dudley public can trust in their local hospital to know that, yes, there are things that are happening. There are things being put in place to make my care as best as it can be. So it's very reassuring to see that.
So another topic that we want to touch on is, like you said, you oversee resident doctors. And what are the challenges do you think the resident doctors have been facing the last few years?
I think one of the major challenges the resident doctors feeling, I think, is kind of when they look forward and look back, I think they look back to kind of how training was and how kind of the work environment was kind of in years gone by. I think that comparison isn't kind of as good, because when I started, I think the hospitals felt a lot smaller. I think we've expanded our teams in anaesthetics. So we've gone from 20 consultants to 40. Kind of there are more doctors. When I started, on my team, there were two surgeons, three resident doctors, and we were it, if you know what I mean. We were on call, yes, every Wednesday for 24 hours, and that was hard, but there was a real team.
It was kind like of a firm,
yeah,
sort of.
It was a firm structure, and we knew each other. We were on call with the same people all the time. The hospital felt a lot smaller and closer, if you know what I mean. But now I think we've expanded our rotas, so kind of that firm is now 6 consultants and 15 residents, and kind of with the shift patterns, people work differently all the time. So I think a lot of the challenge the residents face is and it's our challenge too, is making the residents feel kind of welcome, that they're part of the team, if you know what I mean. And it goes back to this rotational bit, where a resident's only here for 3 or 6 months, works with a few people and then moves on, and actually they don't feel that they're part of the community, if you know
what
I mean.
Do you think there are consultants who feel guilty about, you know, having this feeling that, well, this resident's going to move in 4 months, I don't have to like put that much effort into this?
That's a difficult question because I would say our consultants here, we've got a very proud record of teaching, and kind of all our kind of consultants are kind of really keen to teach. And I think, probably flipping your question a little bit, would they prefer to have one resident with them all the time who they could mentor and treat? Yes, they would. And I think kind of, I think the residents would like that too. So kind of, but we are where we are. We have big teams, and yes.
We have big teams, and the turnover is also quick.
Yes.
And, you know, there's not a lot we can do about that. I mean, even from the view of the public, you know, they might think, oh, why am I seeing so many doctors, you know, and that continuity is not quite maybe what it was, but it's just the challenge of having to train so many people. But even then, it seems the challenges are still there generally of only a limited number of training positions, despite the increasing number. Whereas we still have so many doctors trying to get into training and trying to progress through training. There's the patients on the end of that as well, who might want to see their same doctors, but sometimes it's just not possible in the current climate.
Mm-hmm. That is a very common complaint from the public, that they never see the same doctor again.
Mm.
I think it's one of those challenges that need to be addressed, but nobody knows how.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of it's difficult here, the step up from resident to consultants. Obviously, when we've got consultants, they're here for 20, 30 years. And if a patient has got a chronic illness, or, you know, for example, if you're going through a cancer journey, you will have one consultant in charge of your care who will oversee that. But it's the teams around them who can sometimes move.
Junior doctors and the whole industrial strike action and the difficulties navigating that, being a responsible officer and doctors fighting for, what they believe is their right to their kind of pay, as we look at how things were previously and how pay is changing and how they feel that restoration still needs to happen. Yes, we understand, strike is something that is legal and, in many other aspects of, or many other companies, these things happen. I guess the difficulty now is, this is a environment that's a little bit more sensitive, right? Because we have got patient care at the end of it. So it's just a bit of a challenge, isn't it? Because the doctors need to balance, yes, optimum patient care with also still fighting for what they believe is their optimum working environment and pay for the job that they are doing. I don't know, have you had any conversations with any of the doctors, or is there a general kind of view navigating this?
Yeah, so obviously any period of industrial action is a challenge in any number of ways. And the kind of resident doctor strikes. I imagine you call them juniors. It's like marathon and Snickers. It's kind of sometimes I get it wrong too. It's not intentional. But I think there's two aspects to it. I think I'll not comment on the reasons for the industrial action. I think that is a dispute between the resident doctors and the governments, and kind of it's, from a trust point of view, it's a bit frustrating. You just kind of always say, kind of, we don't take sides, but please, we desperately want a resolution, because it's not good for anyone. It's not good for the trust, for the patients, or the residents themselves. So hopefully we've all got our fingers firmly crossed that there will be some resolution in there. And then I think, taking a broader view, I think, we and I respect anyone's right to take industrial action if they feel that's the right thing to do, and we've got to balance that with keeping the hospital safe and operational, and kind of getting all our patients kind of, you know, the care they need during those times. I think from a personal point of view, and I think kind of obviously these periods of strike action have been going on for a number of times now. I think we're at 15 or 16 we've had. So yeah, so it's been very good. But I think myself, because I was the deputy medical director and my old boss, the previous medical director, I think kind of we took the view at the start, it's actually the residents who are taking industrial actions, they're our colleagues. And actually they're our colleagues hopefully for the future. So what we need to be able to do is have just a clear, open dialogue and actually kind of keep those channels of communication open. So hopefully kind of people can make their choices either to take industrial action or to not, and nobody feels discriminated or pressurized one way or the other. And I think hopefully we've managed to do that. We do have kind of a good dialogue with the BMA around trying to kind of maintain those relations afterwards. Because, you know, when the strikes finish, the resident and the doctors are back in work, and we need to make sure kind of, you know, that we can harmonize that as best we can. Yeah. It's not without its challenges because, you know, every period of action does put quite a lot of strain on the rest of the hospital, which is difficult, but hopefully we've managed to kind of circumnavigate that.
Yeah.
It kind of avoids that us versus them sort of talk. But how does the hospital manage when we go rogue and go on industrial action?
I think you've just got to kind of take a step back and say, what are the priorities? So kind of, you know, first off, it's got to be urgent and emergency care kind of way. We can't shut ED, so there will be ambulances and patients walking up who are kind of unwell and need that urgent care. So you kind of, and it goes on from there. So it's kind of, you know, have we got our emergency pathways good? All the patients that are in the hospital kind of, in ward beds, are they going to get the daily reviews and their treatment progressed as well as they can? And then we look at the planned care kind of, and again, it's urgent cancer and then patients with long week, and we just try and prioritize as best we can. And hopefully we can keep the majority of our service running, if not all of them. But yes, we just have to prioritize. Yes.
Yeah. So it seems, you know, a lot of the work, as you said, is important in maintaining the team dynamics. You know, things like these strikes, they happen, and it's what we have to deal with. But as you said, you know, sometimes the important thing is maintaining those strong team dynamics. So when they're over, we can still work harmoniously with each other and the hospital can run at its optimum. I suppose my question following up from that then is, how do we, or what are the things that we can do, or what things are in place to encourage the doctors, or is there any advice that you'd give for our residents at the moment, given all the challenges that they're facing? Resident doctors at the start of their residency, those nearer to the end of their residency, any general advice that you would give? I suppose you might just need to put yourself back into their shoes.
Well, whether or not it's advice or kind of just one thing to hand on, which is just try and retain a sense of optimism. Yeah, being a doctor is a fantastic career. It's a privilege, kind of, and yeah, I've really enjoyed it, and it keeps giving kind of every single day, if you know what I mean. It is a real challenge, and I know sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's, you know, when we get those emotive patients, but at the end of the day, just, yeah, everything does get better. Kind of be that kind of, you know, your career kind of as you get into more senior roles and you find that kind of that place for yourself, if you know what I mean. So it's just trying to retain that sense of optimism. And I know it's difficult. I know kind of, yeah, but you mentioned the training places. Not everyone is able to get the training place that they want. But overall, it is still a really good career, which has so many kind of advantages to it.
Yeah.
So obviously the other challenge, as we mentioned, was training numbers. And I assume that you are part of this whole 10-point plan in the NHS.
Yes.
What do you think that would have an impact on the frontline staff, just the hospital in general, not just the resident doctors?
Yeah, so I think the training numbers thing, I can't say that's kind of the training numbers are done nationally, and we work with the deanery, and we kind of, we've still got opportunities. We could take more kind of training numbers if the kind of the doctors were attracted to them. I think the 10-point plan specifically with regard to the resident doctors, but other groups of staff, I think it's just, it looks quite a lot of those backroom functions, kind of, you know, kind of, but also kind of, you know, the rosters, are we getting the rosters in time? Are they working time compliant? Are people getting sufficient rest and time for the training within those rosters? And that's really important. And then, you know, with the kind of exception reporting, how we monitor when people are having to continually stay late or work over. And it's really important that actually kind of we get the working conditions right to allow people to thrive properly. And it's, some of it is, you know, kind of stuff like the, you know, the payroll when you move between hospitals. It doesn't have to feel like a fight every time that people get the right pay at the right time, kind of, you know, get their annual leave kind of accepted in timely fashion and things like that. So a lot of it is just trying to improve, yeah, kind of people's experience of working here, so they can concentrate on actually doing the work and not having to do the kind of administration for it.
So what do you think we might be seeing more of now, or looking ahead, if we're maintaining that optimism in the NHS or generally in our local?
I think kind of, you know, the 10-point plan is there, and we talk about these left shift, hospital to community, treatment to prevention, and analog to digital. And I think it's looking at some of the ways we've been able to get that really good ambulance performance. It's actually our community teams keeping patients in care homes, kind of a virtual ward, looking after patients in their own home, delivering that hospital level care. Because, you know, and it is just that, do we need to bring someone into a hospital bed when they get deconditioned just for intravenous antibiotics, when actually someone can go to the care home and deliver the same treatment there? So it's really maximizing those pathways. And I think there will be a bit about where we deliver care for Wales. We've got a community diagnostic center, and we've kind of we've now got a suite at Maryhill, the shopping centre, where actually we're doing bloods, but we're looking to increase the diagnostic offer down there as well. And actually, so in the long term, what does kind of community care look like? And it may be kind of, you know, consultants and diagnostics and one-stop clinics on a high street in a shopping centre, and actually people able to access where they need, so they don't have to come here and, you know, fight for the car park.
Yeah.
Actually, they can go somewhere where actually it's a bespoke kind of centre and things like that. So I think there will be a lot of kind of, yes, moving care out closer to people's homes. But more importantly, how we, as a hospital, we work with our community teams and our primary care teams to wrap around it to stop duplication and seamless movement up those pathways. So kind of, you know, we're one service, not, you don't have to see them to get referred to them to get referred to them. Actually, it's one referral, and then you're just in part of that pathway.
So it sounds like kind of that efficiency and smooth running of the system as a whole is hopefully going forward is what we will start to see in.
And efficiency comes from quality, kind of, you know, and I think it's back to that. It's focus on the quality pathway. What does really good look like? And if it's really good, efficiency falls out of it, if you know what I mean. It's not just efficiency for efficiency's sake. It's actually quality for quality's sake. And everything else comes from there.
So I've got one, maybe two questions. So how long have you been a medical director for?
Slightly less than Liz Truss managed. So I started on the 1st of February. So kind of just over 6 weeks.
So far, right, has there been, from beginning of, you know, when you became a consultant, has there been a moment where you were like, yes, this is what I was born to do?
Not especially. I mean, I think kind of I've worked here for a long time, so it was really nice. A lot of people were very supportive of me and have said some kind of nice things about how, hopefully, kind of doing, you know, Yes, we can do some good work here, if you know what I mean. So there's not been one moment, but I think there have been a few times, like I say, when we first landed the 45 minutes. But that wasn't myself. That was a team effort across the hospital. And it was just bits of not this is what I was born to do, but actually, yes, we can do this, if you know what I mean. And I think it is that, because it did feel difficult and almost impossible. When it landed, it was, yeah, we can.
Thank you so much, Paul.
No worries.
Thank you for coming on to our podcast. Brilliant having you on. And it's just so good to hear, you know, from leadership, especially, I think, from our staff and even members of the community who listen to the podcast. And we can connect and start to bridge that gap just more and more. And I think it's some exciting things to be looking forward to, both as doctors and even as members of the public who know that care is something that is constantly being renewed, and lots of innovative things are coming into play with virtual wards and so on and so forth, which I'm sure we'll explore in some future podcasts as well. But thank you so much for your time. No, we do appreciate
thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone who's been listening. We look forward to welcome you on the next one.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS. And subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.